and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Sharma Shields. Sharma Shields is the author of the short story collection Favorite Monster, which was selected by Stuart Onan as the winner of the 2011 Autumn House Fiction Prize. Stories from the collection have appeared widely in such journals as Kenyon Review and Iowa Review. Sharma lives in Spokane with her husband, son, and newborn daughter. Welcome to Prosody, Sharma.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm so happy to be here.
How about we start with you reading a little bit?
That sounds great. I'm going to read a few lines from a story called Brains and Beauty. I'm going to skip around a little bit. This story is about a woman who is reflecting on the time when her brother was turned to stone by their playmate, who happens to be Medusa. There had been, of course, the expected urgings to sue the Gorgons, my parents' neighbors, for turning their son into a pillar of stone. But my parents were sensible and kind by nature, and they agreed with the Gorgons that what had transpired was merely a horrible accident, a childhood playdate gone terribly awry. Nonetheless, after several months of deep effort, despite all of their good-natured, well-meaning intentions, my parents ultimately could not stand the sight of the snake-haired girl. Nor could they stomach her apologizing, clumsy, impoverished parents. And so we moved away from Spokane to Seattle, where my father found work as an architect's assistant. Bernard remained with us, firmly secured in the backyard, not far from the matching cement bird feeder, his stone sneakers rooted firmly into a patch of dirt that Mom decorated with tulips and irises, his cruel little face wearing its perennial pursed, teasing expression. Every morning, rain or shine, Mom sent me out to scrub off the guano and pollen from his marble frame. Sometimes when bored, I would play with him, dressing him up in my own clothes until my parents, irritated, ordered me to stop. At night, in bed, I thought about Medusa with a restless gratefulness, anxious for the sadness of my parents, but relieved that Bernard was now harmless. By turning my brother to stone, she had saved me countless hours of taunting and torture and terror. An added benefit, too, was that I was now, despite his omnipresence in the grass, the only child. I received the near total of my parents' affection and financial support. The story continues a little bit, and then I'm going to pick it up again when she talks about leaving home as a teenager to start at the university. College proved to be a happy diversion from the woes of my family, and sometimes I forgot about Medusa and Bernard and my pained parents entirely. There was studying to be done, and drinking, and lovemaking, some of them more rewarding and enjoyable than others. Despite the mildly hedonistic lifestyle I led, I graduated with distinction and then went on to medical school and became, of all things, a boring old dentist. It just so happened that an extremely well-paying job opened up in Spokane, and I accepted it immediately, lured by the affordable housing and proximity to lakes and to the memories of multiple sunny days in a row, a characteristic that Seattle had greatly lacked. As expected, I visited my parents in my moment of transitioning. I was disturbed to find that they had dragged Bernard out of the yard and had placed him next to the fireplace in the living room. He stared cruelly at me as my parents and I gathered on the old familiar sofas. The three of us chatted inanely, as people do when they don't know what to say to one another. The mood in the house was awkward. Every now and again, my mother would turn to Bernard as if he were about to speak, her eyes shining and desperate. When he gave no response, she withdrew into the sad recesses of her mind. To encourage her reawakening, I leaned forward and touched her knee and told her some humorous story from my college years. Her eyes would flit over to me again, where I sat happy and lovely, vibrant and full-grown, so contrary to the short statue of her little boy, and she would smile vaguely, as if reading some bad joke on my face. I began to wonder if she was losing her mind. When I mentioned this later in private to Dad, he frowned at me angrily and said that they had been through quite a lot in their life, and would I mind terribly giving them some peace and quiet? After all, he said, no parents like to feel like their child is judging them. I said no, that I wouldn't mind, and that I was sorry if he felt judged. He apologized to me for snapping, and then confessed to me softly that sometimes, in the recent years since I'd left home, they'd imagined that Bernard had moved. After such a suspicion, they could no longer keep him in the yard. Every day they watched him for more movement. "And has there been any?" I asked, silencing the judging part of my brain. Dad shrugged. "Sometimes," he said, "it would seem so." Apparently, the movement was too faint to be sure.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the winner of the 2011 Autumn House Fiction Prize, Sharma Shields, for her collection of short stories, Favorite Monster. Sharma, one of the things that I think is really intriguing about this collection is the kind of contract you have to form with the reader from the beginning of each story, because you kind of come forward with these extraordinary situations. There's a boy who's been turned to a pillar of stone. We have a cyclops who works in an office. We have a serial killer who lives across the street. And so I just wondered if you could kind of talk about how you ease your reader into the sense of the familiar in an unfamiliar world with your stories.
I think the way I kind of cheat at that is I don't so much ease them as thrust them into that immediately with the first line. I try to let them know from the very first get-go that this is going to be a strange story. The reality here, even if the emotional landscapes are similar, the reality is a little convoluted. It's a little strange. And I try to just be frank about that up front. And I think that that's what helps, hopefully.
Yeah, because it's, I guess the reason I said ease, and you're right. You do kind of just like start with a sentence that says, here's where we're at. There's a cyclops working in an office, or there's my brother got turned to stone. But there's also something about the world that feels really familiar. So when you're thinking about your work, you know, usually these are the kind of creatures that you might see. You create like avatars for video games, and this is the person you want to be, or it's in the world of fantasy. But this is, to me, is not fantasy fiction. This is fiction that's still kind of dealing with terrains of, because for me, sometimes fantasy fiction becomes more about the action and the world. And these are still really rooted in kind of character and heart and struggle in that. So could you talk about that a little bit, like how you walk that line?
Sure. Well, I do try to think of, you know, very sincere, I think I mentioned emotional landscapes. And I think that works well for me thinking about the story. For example, with the Brains and Beauty, the story about Medusa and the brother that was turned to stone, I really wanted to focus less on that detail of him being turned to stone. I almost use that detail for humor. Mm-hmm. It's sort of kind of the funny stuff in the story, but there's some very serious emotion there where the sister she was sort of terrified of her brother as a little kid, and then she feels quite a bit of guilt that this horrible thing happened to him, but that she feels that she benefited from it. And I think when I wrote the story, I was thinking very much about sibling rivalry, and, you know, thinking about my relationship with my brother. I dredge a lot of my own emotions. I dig down and bring those up, and I put them directly into the story. And maybe, you know, the excessive make-believe quality allows me to be a little more honest with those emotions with myself. So I think that's probably, you know, why that combination can exist. I do definitely think of the stories as literary pieces and not mm-hmm. fantasy. But I know that they're weird, too. I kind of like the weirdness, I guess.
Well, and there's a lot of kind of literary reference in them as well, right?
Yes.
In the story with the Cyclops, we're referencing the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. In There's a story where a man shrinks. That's metamorphosis.
Yes.
There's one with a serial killer. It reminded me of A Good Man Is Hard to Find. You know, that kind of unusual premise that Flannery O'Connor kind of, you know, broke the ground for, that the thing that you're most afraid of, let's pretend that it actually exists.
Yeah, definitely.
So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Sharma Shields, winner of the 2011 Autumn House Fiction Prize for her collection of short stories, Favorite Monster. Sharma, could you read some more?
Sure, I'd love to. I'm going to read a few scenes from a short story called The McGoogle Account. Autumn House Press was just kind enough to nominate this story for a pushcart prize, and it also appeared in the Iowa Review. So this is the McGoogle account. I'll start out reading just the first paragraph, and then I'll read some other sections from it. We were all surprised when Brian hired the Cyclops. His references only spoke Greek. His sole job experience was shepherding. It was uncertain if he could commit to 2 years. No matter. Brian saw something formidable in him. He had followed a similar hunch when he hired me. Despite my lack of PR experience and despite my nervous stutter during the interview, I had become one of our company's top performers. We're going to move forward a little bit to when she is introduced to the Cyclops. Around me, chairs scraped back and polite laughter ballooned. Brian was introducing the Cyclops around the office. I told my client I would call her back and hung up. Brian and the Cyclops approached my desk, smiling broadly. I stood and extended my hand. Like prairie dogs risen from their earthen holes, the heads of my colleagues bobbed above the cubicle walls, their expressions less curious than bored. With a sense of wonderment, I allowed the Cyclops' hand to swallow up my own. "It's a delight to meet you, Miss Horn," he said. "Brian was raving about your work here." So soft his voice, as though it could lull you to sleep. He was very well spoken for a Cyclops. I told this to my colleague Kent later that day. Kent grunted and rolled his eyes. "More proof of Brian's incompetence," Kent said. His gelled hair sat stiffly on his head like the shining blade of a guillotine. "He's obviously a monster. Did you smell him?" "Like cooked garbage," an intern agreed. "I thought he was nice," I said. We were standing around the fax machine, five or six of us, waiting for our faxes to crawl out of the machine's unsmiling mouth. "Nice" is the adjective people use when they don't have something better to say, Kent intoned. Then he sang loudly, "Carol's found a new boyfriend." My coworkers laughed. "Yeah, right," I said with feigned playfulness. "I mean, come on, he's totally gross. Really, he's disgusting." But truthfully, I didn't find the Cyclops gross or disgusting. Aside from the large club he carried, for wolves or worse, he told me, and despite the smell of livestock that trailed him everywhere, he was far more refined and thoughtful than the other men in the office. His pants, while faintly stained, were always neatly pressed. He could quote entire poems of Yeats and Sappho. Even more impressive was that he always asked everyone, no matter how busy he was, how his or her day was going. Clients perceived his incongruity as a sign of superiority and began requesting his services. To my delight, we were teamed up on a new project together, and after a few engaging weeks, I complimented him on his impressive vocabulary and grammar. "I read a lot of books in the field," the Cyclops explained. He meant field literally, as in the field where he shepherded goats. I pictured him lolling on a vast green hillside, his feet and chest bare, holding a hardcover book above his face at just the right angle to block the hot Mediterranean sun.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the writer Sharma Shields, who is the winner of the 2011 Autumn House Fiction Prize for her collection of short stories, Favorite Monster. One of the things I'm wondering about in terms of the stories, as a writer, having these fantastical creatures in the work, I guess the question I'm wondering about is keeping... how you keep returning to that world and keep finding something fresh every time. As a writer, what remains interesting to you about, you know, kind of creating this? It feels to me like it's the human world meeting this other world, you know, and this kind of slippage in between the two of them. Because I would think at times you might, I'm wondering if you're concerned that it could become something, and I don't think this is true of the work. I think each one of the stories is really fresh and interesting and new, but it could become kind of a method. So mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Let's see. I think I do look at each of the pieces individually. They were all written at a different part of my life. For example, the McGoogle account, the Cyclops story, really was born from a job that I had as a salesperson. And it was the sort of company that you see in the McGoogle account, even though that's a PR firm. But, you know, it's very, it's kind of a position where the woman is likely making a fair amount of money. They have interns that are working for them, much like I did in my job as a salesperson. The world, in fact, I even had a boss named Brian, and there's a boss named Brian in this story. My husband asked me, why aren't you going to change that? And I was like, I really like the sound of the boss named Brian. But this is a fictional Brian. He's not my boss.
And the Cyclops isn't named Brian, so you're not making any comment on your former boss.
That's right. the Cyclops is named the Cyclops. Very original. So, there was this sort of frustration while I was in this job that it was taking up a lot of my time, and that job had kind of become my world, but it didn't feel like I was doing what I wanted to be doing, which, of course, was writing. So I think that was kind of the origin for the story, in a sense. But then when I sat down to write it, the first line, you know, we were all surprised when Brian hired the Cyclops, was what popped out. And I think I wrote the first draft in like an hour, probably.
Sure.
And it was a very short first draft. But
was this the first story in this kind of one of the things I think that's interesting about your work is, even though we get these extraordinary characters who, you know, serial killers do exist in the world, but hopefully not many of them, and we never encounter them. But, you know, we're not going to see a Cyclops walking down the street. We're not going to see a boy on a lawn, a man who's shrinking. They're extraordinary in their circumstances, but they're not the most extraordinary people in the stories. Mm-hmm. The most extraordinary That's people right. in the stories are the people who are interacting with them and what we learn because of that interaction. So was this the first story in kind of this vein? Because I'm thinking, like, then the next time you sit down to write and one of these fantastical creatures comes up, is it, oh, you know, I'm not sure if I should go down that vein again, or somehow it becomes a tool that you can use that kind of opens up your writing in a way? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
I think the latter. I think it became a tool for me a bit. The Cyclops story was not the first of the monster stories I wrote. The first one, oddly enough, was the writer's werewolf story. And that came to me, and this is the only time this has ever happened, and it will probably never happen again. I dreamt that entire story from start to finish.
Wow.
And then I wrote it down in some journal on some piece of paper somewhere. And I came across it a couple years later, and I was like, oh, this is hilarious, this dream I had. I should just write the entire thing down. So I did. That was kind of the first monster story.
Monster and then encounter.
Yeah. And then the Cyclops one came not too far after that. And I wrote the Cyclops one and the serial killer one around the same time. And I didn't think at the time, oh, serial killer equals monster. I just thought it was kind of a funny, you know, take on having this woman fall in love, making bad choices in love, and decides to fall in love with a serial killer. And that was very much inspired by the Yates case in Spokane. He was a man who lived in the same neighborhood as my parents, and I actually was there at my parents' house, home from college, when he was arrested for, you know, murdering women and burying them in his backyard. And he was a family man with four grown daughters. But it was it was later, after the Cyclops piece was published in the Iowa Review, and I was compiling my stories together, that I realized in some sense or another, there was a monster in every single story. Whether or not the monster was literal, like Cyclops or Medusa, or whether it was figurative, a teenage girl trying to fit in with her peers and doing something really monstrous to another person, that was kind of when the theme really congealed for me. And I did write the Medusa one and the Chirp of the Cricket, the one about the shrinking man. I did write those in response to that realization. And I think that's what kind of made the collection cohere.
Sure. And that's what I was thinking in these two worlds kind of colliding, because and you said it just in your response, the who is the monster in the story isn't necessarily who outwardly appears to be the monster. Mm-hmm. A lot of it, and I know, I think that's why I thought of the Flannery O'Connor story, in that, most people these days, I think with horror, think that it's easily to identify, one, because you get the horror music in the movie, but also because of some kind of appearance, oh, there's the person that we need to be afraid of. But in the stories, that's also like how you create this kind of contract with your reader, that after you start to read the second or the third one, you understand as a reader, you need to be looking around, because who is the most extraordinary in their appearance oftentimes ends up being the kindest person in the story.
Yes, yes. And I think that was really intentional on my part. I think of the story Pulchritudinous, in which, the teenage girl does something really, cruel to another person. Well, earlier in the story, she had done something really kind for that person. And I think that's what the narrator ends up grappling with in the story, is how can I be this person that does, both of these things? How can I be a person that's filled with kindness and with cruelty, that can be, both a saint and a monster? And I think I ask those questions because, probably because of my own regrets and desires, and my own wanting to be a better person.
Sure. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest is the winner of the 2011 Autumn House Fiction Prize, Sharma Shields, for her collection of short stories, Favorite Monster. Sharma, could you read some more?
Sure. So this is the serial killer story, as we are calling it. The title is Souvenirs, and this appeared in Fugue. He was my serial killer. I call him mine because he lived across the street from me. Some people would find this worrisome, frightening even. Not me. I grew up in Spokane. There are rapists and serial killers and pedophiles on most street corners in Spokane. And it gets to the point that if you're walking through River Park Square and the rapist, serial killer, pedophile happens to be approaching from the other direction, you may as well just smile and greet him like you would anyone else. This doesn't happen on the west side. I know, because my ex is from Seattle and he never said hello to anyone.
So one of the things I love about your stories as well is the humor in them. They're kind of pushing boundaries in all kinds of ways. We've got characters that we don't anticipate to see. We get this level of kind of tension between intimacy between the characters, and we learn kind of about awkwardness in that regard. And as you were talking about this, how can I be a person who has these contradictions within myself? And then we've got, moments where it's just laugh out loud funny. And so I wanted to talk about the humor. Whether that's something that just kind of comes from your own voice that works its way into the stories? Do you have to kind of work with language in order to get that to pop? I know it's hard to talk about humor, but you've also won awards for your humor. So I'm just, is it your perspective? Is it in the language? Is it in the circumstances? Is it all of the above? Like, how do you make your stories funny?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, there's a sort of pushing some boundaries. Pedophiles should not be funny, but I think by this narrator suggesting, that it's just blasé to see a pedophile walking around, it's surprising. And I think when I try to add humor to my work, I'm looking for that sense of surprise, because I think it makes people laugh to see something that should be treated seriously, treated really lightly, or something that should be treated, you know, a dark subject, for example, a taboo subject, is treated, you know, lightheartedly. And I think that that creates a good element of surprise and can add some humor. I also, in the first paragraph, was really playing with the whole Spokane versus Seattle tension, which I don't think is there for people from Seattle, but it's very much there for people from Spokane. You know, Seattle's on the west side. It's very liberal. It's very educated. They, I think, fortunately, tend to swing votes in Washington State toward the liberal agenda. Spokane is more conservative, a little bit less educated of a community, but, you know, there's just always this, oh, those Seattle snobs. And then I think Seattle people look at the Spokaneites as, oh, that town still exists over there, you know. But so there's this funny play there that I was trying to, you know, toy with a bit and kind of an inside joke. But I think probably all states have that sort of tension. Sure. Between you know, one area versus another. So,
well, and there's a lot in your work between, and so you've brought up landscape a little bit, civility and wilderness. And again, yes, this kind definitely. Of switch between where is the civility and where is the wildness. And so I was also wondering if that's just something that, you know, again, in a highly urbanized area, sometimes it's hard for us to kind of think about those boundaries. But being from the Northwest, landscape seems to be something that you also use to kind of probe those issues as well.
Yes, and that is actually really beautiful of you to say. I didn't even realize that in my work, but I think it's really true that there is, I mean, it makes me think of the story Neighborhood, in which this woman is living in a neighborhood where all of the houses, they start kind of competing with making their front yards look fancy. And they do it in these really bizarre ways. But in the end, she tries to make her yard look fancy by inviting, you know, deer and squirrels in and having some bird feeders. And then she ends up, I think, you know, shooting the deer with tranquilizers and chaining them to the fence. And that's when everybody loves the yard. But I think the Northwest really gave me a love of, you know, the mountains and the forests. And my family has property at Lake Pendere that in a way was more influential to me than growing up in Spokane, because your imagination, I think, when you're outside and when you're walking around, and I think it can happen on a city street too, but when you're out in the woods, your imagination, especially as a child, just soars. So I think that does play into the collection quite a bit. And I am fascinated by landscape, I think in particular because I always meant to leave Spokane in the Northwest, and I've never left. And I don't think I ever will now. I do love it. I feel like it's a part of me. So it's a part of my fiction, too.
Great. Thanks for coming, Sharma.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, 90.5 WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Lisa Alexander and Michelle Stoner. Please tune in every Saturday at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.